injured citizens was immediately coming upon him. Dewar still expected to be freed by Hamilton's miraculous intervention. In fact, the Treasury Secretary had already decided to make an example of Dewar, informing a friend, "There should be a line of separation between honest men and knaves, between respectable stockholders and dealers in the funds, and mere unprincipled gamblers. Public infamy must restrain what the laws cannot." Hamilton's letters to William Seton during these weeks mingle sadness and horror as he contemplated the plight of those destroyed by the panic. Hamilton's critics gloated over these events as vindicating their critique of his system. For the slaveholding South, this was irrefutable proof of Northern depravity. Jefferson inveighed against the criminality of this paper system and said people would now return to plain, unsophisticated common sense. With a touch of schadenfreude, he computed that the $5 million squandered by speculators equaled the combined value of all New York real estate. Madison observed with satisfaction, "The gambling system is beginning to exhibit its explosions. Dewar, the prince of the tribe of speculators, has just become a victim of his enterprises." Hamilton was appalled to learn of Madison's allegation that his purchases of government securities to steady the market had been made at high prices to benefit speculators. This complete misconception of his virtuoso performance was hard for Hamilton to stomach, and he told a Virginia friend, "It left no doubt in anyone's mind that Mr. Madison was actuated by personal and political animosity." That Hamilton did not exaggerate the vindictive mood of Madison and the Southern congressman is confirmed in a letter Abigail Adams wrote about the panic to her sister. "The Southern members are determined, if possible, to ruin the Secretary of the Treasury, destroy all his well-built systems, and, if possible, give a fatal stab to the funding system." Her husband, the vice president, had managed to harmonize the Senate, but this did not stem the regional rancor. "I firmly believe if I live 10 years longer, I shall see a division of the Southern and Northern states unless more candor and less intrigue, of which I have no hopes, should prevail," she wrote. William Dewar's downfall exposed the magnitude of the securities market that Hamilton had opened up. It also showed how easily the market for government bonds could be rigged by swindlers planting false rumors and exploiting the auction system for stock trades. To provide more orderly markets, 24 brokers gathered on May 17th under the shade of a buttonwood tree at 68 Wall Street and drew up rules to govern securities trading. This historic buttonwood agreement set a minimum for brokers' commissions and laid the foundations for what became the New York Stock Exchange. It attested to the extraordinary, if sometimes combustible, vigor of the capital markets that Hamilton had single-handedly brought into being. A year later, trading in government bonds grew so brisk that the Buttonwood Group adjourned to an upstairs room of the new Tontine Coffee House, a 3-story brick structure at Wall and Water Streets, right near Hamilton's New York home. Its first president was Archibald Gracie, whose East River mansion was to house New York mayors. Local wits christened the Tontine Coffee House Scrip Castle in honor of Hamilton's bank scrip, which had triggered expanded share trading. Henceforth, Wall Street would signal much more than a short, narrow lane in Lower Manhattan. It would symbolize an industry, a sector of the economy, a state of mind, and it became synonymous with American finance itself. On July 4, 1792, a full-length portrait of Hamilton, painted by John Trumbull on the commission of New York's Grateful Merchants, went up in City Hall. Lest he seem self-aggrandizing, Hamilton consented to the project with one caveat, that the painting appear unconnected with any incident of my political life. Trumbull painted Hamilton frequently, 2 original portraits and 15 replicas, and captured him here in his prime, with only the slightest shadow of a double chin. The Treasury Secretary gazes off into the distance with visionary confidence. Very refined, he stands by his desk in a pale suit, his body slim and shapely, one bare hand poised on his desk, the other elegantly gloved and holding a second glove. His black cloak is draped over a nearby chair. In tribute to Hamilton's literary powers, a pen is dipped in an inkwell. With his face illuminated by a good-natured smile, he radiates a quiet, buoyant energy and seems ready for many more triumphs. The 1792 financial panic came on the heels of the two great projects by which Hamilton hoped to excite the public with the shimmering prospects for American manufacturing: the Society for Establishing Useful Manufactures and submission of his report on manufactures. The outlook for both was badly damaged by the panic. Even a short list of the worst offenders in the share mania: William Dewar, Alexander Macomb, New York broker John Dewhurst, Royal Flint, included so many SEUM directors that it almost sounded like a company venture. Dewar's notoriety was especially detrimental since he had been SEUM governor, its largest shareholder, and its chief salesman in hawking securities. When Hamilton dispatched his friend Nicholas Lowe to sound out Dewar in prison, the unyielding financier refused to resign as SEUM governor or account for the whereabouts of society funds. People who had pledged to purchase shares retreated in droves as the society's good name was muddied. The remaining SEUM directors rummaged through its books to assess the damage and were dismayed to learn that Dewar had emptied the society's bank accounts for his own use. "I trust they are not diverted," Hamilton had warned Dewar in a letter. "The public interest and my reputation are deeply concerned in this matter." When the panic had hit, Dewar had had $10,000 of society funds in his possession, and that money now simply vanished. It turned out he had taken a liberal $50,000 loan from the SEUM Treasury, though much of this was recouped when shares he pledged as collateral were sold. And another $50,000 to buy textile machinery had gone to John Dewhurst, who had absconded with the funds to Pennsylvania. When the Society Board held its quarterly meeting in New Brunswick, New Jersey that April, the New York directors were so distracted by the mayhem that not a single one showed up. Deputy Governor Archibald Mercer appealed to Hamilton to assist us in our operations as far as it is in your power. To revive the board's spirits, Hamilton promised to try to arrange loans for the society and suggested it hire needed workmen from Europe. What quickly became apparent was that the board was rife with financiers who were abysmally ignorant of industrial matters. "For my part, I confess myself perfectly ignorant of every duty relating to the manufacturing business," Mercer admitted to Hamilton while begging him to attend a special society meeting in mid-May. Intent upon salvaging the enterprise, Hamilton stole several days from his treasury schedule to confer with the board. How exactly would the SEUM, its coffers cleaned out by Dewar, pay for its property on the Passaic River? Hamilton privately approached William Seaton at the Bank of New York and arranged a $5,000 loan at a reduced 5% interest rate. He cited high-minded reasons, including the public interest and the advantage to New York City of having a manufacturing town across the Hudson, but more than the public interest was at stake. "To you, my dear sir, I will not scruple to say, in confidence, that the Bank of New York shall suffer no diminution of its pecuniary faculties from any accommodations it may afford to the society in question. I feel my reputation concerned in its welfare." The SEUM's collapse, Hamilton knew, could jeopardize his own career. In promising Seaton that he would see to it, as Treasury Secretary, that the Bank of New York was fully compensated for any financial sacrifice entailed by the SEUM loan, Hamilton mingled too freely his public and private roles. For several days in early July 1792, Hamilton huddled with the society directors to hammer out a new program. "Perseverance in almost any plan is better than fickleness and fluctuation," he was to lecture one superintendent with what could almost have been his personal motto. Rewarding his efforts, the society approved wide-ranging operations: a cotton mill, a textile printing plant, a spinning and weaving operation, and housing for 50 workers on quarter-acre plots. Never timid about his own expertise, Hamilton pinpointed the precise spot for the factory at the foot of the waterfalls that had so impressed him with their strength and beauty during the Revolutionary War. It was an index of the hope generated by Hamilton that the SEUM, at his suggestion, hired Pierre Charles L'Enfant, the architect who had just laid out plans for the new federal city on the Potomac River, to supervise construction of the society's buildings and plan the futuristic town of Patterson. At the same time, it was an index of Hamilton's persistent anxiety that he dipped into managerial minutiae befitting a factory foreman rather than an overworked treasury secretary. For instance, he instructed the directors to draw up an inventory of tools possessed by each worker and stated that, if any were broken, the parts should be returned and a report made to the storekeeper and noted in some proper column. With his reputation at stake, Hamilton even subsidized the venture with his own limited funds, advancing $1,800 to the mechanics. Despite the Dewar fiasco, the SEUM commenced operations in spinning, weaving, and calico printing. The subsequent society records make for pretty dismal reading, as Hamilton was beset by unending troubles. L'Enfant was the wrong man for the job. Instead of trying to conserve money for the cash-strapped society, he contrived extravagant plans for a 7-mile-long stone aqueduct to carry water. He was enthralled by the idea of creating a grand industrial city on the pattern of the nascent Washington, D.C., with long radiating avenues, rather than with building a simple factory. By early 1794, L'Enfant shucked the project and spirited off the blueprints into the bargain. To find qualified textile workers, the society sent scouts to Scotland and paid for the laborers' passage to America. Even the managers clamored for better pay, and SEUM minutes show that some disgruntled artisans personally hired by Hamilton began to sabotage the operation by stealing machinery. One of the saddest parts of the story relates to the employment of children. Whatever hopeful vision Hamilton may have had of children performing useful labor and being educated simultaneously, they had neither the time nor money to attend school. To remedy the problem, the board hired a schoolmaster to instruct the factory children on Sundays, which, as Hamilton must have known, was scarcely a satisfactory solution. By early 1796, with Hamilton still on the board, the society abandoned its final lines of business, discontinued work at the factory, and put the cotton mill up for sale. Hamilton's fertile dream left behind only a set of derelict buildings by the river. At first, it looked as if the venture had completely backfired. During the next 2 years, not a single manufacturing society received a charter in the United States. Hamilton's faith in textile manufacturing in Paterson was eventually vindicated in the early 1800s as a raceway system of canals powered textile mills and other forms of manufacturing, still visible today in the Great Falls Historic District. The city that Hamilton helped to found did achieve fame for extensive manufacturing operations, including foundries, textile mills, silk mills, locomotive factories, and the Colt Gunworks. Hamilton had chosen the wrong sponsors at the wrong time. In recruiting Dewar and L'Enfant, he had exercised poor judgment. He was launching too many initiatives, crowded too close together, as if he wanted to remake the entire country in a flash. The SEUM's problems after the 1792 panic also occurred at a moment when Hamilton's political fortunes were starting to change. His never-ending reports and innovations were rattling the country. As one Jeffersonian writer said after Dewar's comeuppance, Hamilton had talked to them so much of imports, funds, banks, and manufactures that they are considered as the cardinal virtues of the Union. Hence, liberty, independence, have been struck out from the American vocabulary and the hieroglyphs of money inserted in their stead. In September 1792, Elisha Boudinot told Hamilton of rising political protests against the SEUM and warned that a strong party was forming in Philadelphia against the Secretary of the Treasury. He reported that one unidentified Virginian was very violent on the subject and was trying to see what could be done with regard to displacing him. For many Americans, the sheer profusion of Hamilton programs added up to a picture of America's future that frightened them. The financial turmoil on Wall Street and the William Dewar debacle pointed up a glaring defect in Hamilton's political theory. The rich could put their own interests above the national interest. He had always betrayed a special, though never reflexive or uncritical, solicitude for merchants as the potential backbone of the Republic. He once wrote, "That valuable class of citizens forms too important an organ of the general weal not to claim every practicable and reasonable exemption and indulgence." He hoped businessmen would have a broader awareness and embrace the common good. But he was so often worried about abuses committed against the rich that he sometimes minimized the skullduggery that might be committed by the rich. The saga of William Dewar exposed a distinct limitation in Hamilton's political vision. And whatever became of William Dewar? After the 1792 panic, he lingered in prison for 7 years, the remainder of his life. Until the end, he sent Hamilton heart-rending notes, pleading for trifling loans of $10 or $15, which Hamilton granted. During one yellow fever epidemic, Hamilton arranged for Dewar to be transferred to another wing of the prison to protect him from the disease. Dewar did not seem to blame his old friend for his imprisonment, and Hamilton seemed forgiving toward the man who had all but wrecked his manufacturing society and very nearly his reputation. Right before Dewar died in 1799, he wrote movingly to Hamilton, "My affection for yourself and my sensibility for whatever interested your happiness has been ever sincere, and I have felt with pain any appearance of your withdrawing from me." Chapter 20. Corrupt Squadrons. Despite financial panics and the setbacks of his manufacturing society, Alexander Hamilton's touch still seemed golden, his step nimble, and his position impregnable in Washington's administration. He was brimming with bold ideas and enacting them with singular panache. It petrified Jefferson and Madison that the one man in America willing and able to lead the country in precisely the wrong direction was Washington's right-hand man, who seemed to be virtually running the country. As early as May 1791, Madison and Jefferson had begun to organize opposition to the Treasury Secretary's triumphal march. After Hamilton's success with the Bank of the United States, the two Virginians embarked on what seemed a harmless botanizing tour that led them through New York City, up the Hudson River to Lake George, then down through western New England, the heartland of Hamilton's support. As Jefferson observed, it was from New England chiefly that these champions for a king, lord, and commons come. Even though the two men registered copious notes about trees and floral specimens and pulled speckled trout from lakes, their activities thinly camouflaged a more serious agenda. As American politics split along regional lines, Jefferson knew that the South had to make northern inroads to stop the Hamiltonian juggernaut. "There is a vast mass of discontent gathered in the South, and how and when it will break, God knows," Jefferson told Robert R. Livingston on the eve of the trip. In New York, the two Virginians conferred with Livingston as well as Aaron Burr, who had replaced Philip Schuyler as one of New York's two senators. The alert Robert Troup suspected a plot to strip Hamilton of power in his own backyard. There was every appearance of a passionate courtship between the Chancellor, Livingston, Burr, Jefferson, and Madison when the two latter were in town, he apprised Hamilton. "Delenda est Carthago, I suppose, is the maxim adopted with respect to you." "Delenda est Carthago. Carthage must be destroyed and obliterated." These fighting words, quarried from the pages of Roman history, signaled the start of interminable warfare between Hamilton and Jefferson, which was to tear apart Washington's cabinet and the country at large. The conflict went beyond the personal clash between Washington's two most gifted officials and contrasted two enduring visions of American government. Of all the events that shaped the political life of the new republic in its earliest years, Stanley Elkins and Eric McKittrick wrote in their history of the period, none was more central than the massive personal and political enmity, classic in the annals of American history, which developed in the course of the 1790s between Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. This feud, rife with intrigue and lacerating polemics, was to take on an almost pathological intensity. As noted, Hamilton and Jefferson at first enjoyed cordial relations. "Each of us perhaps thought well of the other man," Jefferson recalled, "but as politicians it was impossible for two men to be of more opposite principles." In combating Hamilton's cabinet influence, the courtly Jefferson, who hated confrontation, operated at a severe disadvantage. "I do not love difficulties," he once told John Adams. "I am fond of quiet, willing to do my duty, but made irritable by slander and apt to be forced by it to abandon my post." By contrast, the bumptious Hamilton savored the cut and thrust of controversy. Fast on his feet, sure in his judgments, informed on every issue, he was as dazzling and voluble in debate as Jefferson was retiring. By early 1792, Any pose of civility between the two secretaries disappeared, and Jefferson remembered them daily pitted in the cabinet like two cocks. By the end of their tenure, the two adversaries could scarcely stand each other's presence. Today we cherish the two-party system as a cornerstone of American democracy. The founders, however, viewed parties, or factions as they termed them, as monarchical vestiges that had no legitimate place in a true republic. Hamilton dreaded parties as the most fatal disease of popular governments and hoped America could dispense with such groups. James Kent later wrote, "Hamilton said in The Federalist, in his speeches, and 100 times to me that factions would ruin us and our government had not sufficient energy and balance to resist the propensity to them and to control their tyranny and their profligacy." In many passages in The Federalist, Hamilton and Madison inveighed against malignant factions, although Hamilton conceded in number 26 that the spirit of party in different degrees must be expected to infect all political bodies. Hamilton associated factions with parochial state interests and imagined that federal legislators would be more broad-minded, more out of the reach of those occasional ill humors or temporary prejudices and propensities which in smaller societies frequently contaminate the public councils, he said in number 27. Nevertheless, it was Hamilton, inadvertently, who became the flashpoint for the formation of the first parties. The searing controversy over his programs exploded idyllic fantasies that America would be free of partisan groupings. His charismatic personality and far-reaching policies unified his followers, who gradually became known as Federalists. By capitalizing the term used for supporters of the Constitution, the Federalists tacitly implied that their foes opposed it. The Federalists were allied with powerful banking and merchant interests in New England and on the Atlantic seaboard, and were disproportionately Congregationalists and Episcopalians. At the same time, the mounting fear of Hamilton among Jefferson, Madison, and their supporters cohered into an organized opposition that began to call itself Republican. Alluding to the ancient Roman Republic, this was also a clever label, insinuating that Federalists were not real Republicans and hence must be monarchists. Often Baptists and Methodists, Republicans drew their strength from rich Southern planters and small farmers. They defined their beliefs in large measure by their dread of Hamilton's system and employed anti-Hamilton rhetoric as shorthand to express their solidarity. Jefferson distinguished the two parties by saying that Federalists believed that the executive is the branch of our government which needs most support, while Republicans thought that, like the analogous branch in the English government, it is already too strong for the Republican parts of the Constitution and therefore, in equivocal cases, they inclined to the legislative powers. Elkins and McKittrick describe the emergence of parties as the true novelty of the age and date their onset to around 1792. It is tempting but misleading to think of the Federalists as the patrician party and the Republicans as representing the commoners. The controversy which embroiled the two champions was not basically concerned with the haves and the have-nots, James T. Flexner once wrote of the clash between Hamilton and Jefferson. It was between rival economic systems, each of which was aimed at generating its own men of property. In fact, the Federalist ranks had plenty of self-made men like Hamilton, while the Republicans were led by two men of immense inherited wealth, Jefferson and Madison. Moreover, the political culture of the slaveholding South was marked by much more troubling disparities of wealth and status than was that of the North, and the vast majority of abolitionist politicians came from the so-called aristocrats of the Federalist Party. The sudden emergence of parties set a slashing tone for politics in the 1790s. Since politicians considered parties bad, they denied involvement in them, bristled at charges that they harbored partisan feelings, and were quick to perceive hypocrisy in others. And because parties were frightening new phenomena, they could be easily mistaken for evil conspiracies, lending a paranoid tinge to political discourse. The Federalists saw themselves as saving America from anarchy, while Republicans believed they were rescuing America from counter-revolution. Each side possessed a lurid, distorted view of the other, buttressed by an idealized sense of itself. No etiquette yet defined civilized behavior between the parties. It also was not self-evident that the two parties would smoothly alternate in power, raising the unsettling prospect that one party might be established to the permanent exclusion of the other. Finally, no sense yet existed of a loyal opposition to the government in power. As the party spirit grew more acrimonious, Hamilton and Washington regarded much of the criticism fired at their administration as disloyal, even treasonous in nature. One last feature of the inchoate party system deserves mention. The emerging parties were not yet fixed political groups able to exert discipline on errant members. Only loosely united by ideology and sectional loyalties, they can seem to modernize more like amorphous personality cults. It was as if the parties were projections of individual politicians. Washington, Hamilton, and then John Adams on the Federalist side, Jefferson, Madison, and then James Monroe on the Republican side, rather than the reverse. As a result, the reputations of the principal figures formed decisive elements in political combat. For a man like Hamilton, so watchful of his reputation, the rise of parties was to make him even more hypersensitive about his personal honor. If, on the domestic side, Hamilton's bottomless chest of programs precipitated the rise of parties, equally inflammatory were political convulsions in Europe, specifically whether U.S. policy should tilt toward England or France. Much of the debate's fervor sprang from the fact that the colonists had fought a war against England with France as their chief ally. Beyond this obvious backdrop, England and France functioned as proxies in the domestic debate over what kind of society America should be. For Jefferson and Madison, the problem was not simply that Hamilton was pro-British, but that his policies would replicate aspects of the British government they loathed. And for Hamilton, the French Revolution was a bloody cautionary tale of a revolution gone awry. Jefferson possessed a long-standing grudge against Britain. Back in 1786, he had received a glacial reception in London from British officials, and their insufferable condescension had left a residue of implacable malice. "That nation hates us, their ministers hate us, and their king more than all other men," Jefferson fulminated after 2 months in England. It may be significant that Hamilton, who never visited Europe or experienced firsthand the insolence that stung Jefferson and Franklin, found it easier to warm to the British. Besides the dependence of Virginia tobacco planters upon British credit, Hamilton thought that some Southern hostility toward Britain also dated from wartime experience. It is a fact that the rigor with which the war was prosecuted by the British armies in our southern quarter had produced there more animosity against the British government than in the other parts of the United States. With evergreen memories of the Revolution, many Americans viewed Britain warily, and Hamilton had to preach the unpalatable truth that England was a more suitable trading partner for America than France, the clear sentimental favorite. The United States still had not escaped economic dependence on England, which consumed nearly half of American exports and accounted for 3/4 of American imports. Even that understated the dependence, since many British imports were articles of everyday use, cutlery, pottery, and the like, whereas France specialized in wine, brandy, women's hosiery, and other luxury goods. As an exponent of commercial realism in foreign affairs, Hamilton thought it better for America to operate temporarily as a junior partner in Britain's global trading system than to try to undercut Britain and align itself with France. By virtue of his background, Hamilton may have been well disposed toward the British. His father, descended from Scottish nobility, had probably diverted his son with tales of the British Isles. The illegitimate boy may have identified with his father's lapsed patrician heritage. Nor would Hamilton have felt alone in his emotional affinity for England. The Revolution had been a family feud with all the ambivalent feelings that implied. It had been their violated rights as Englishmen that had driven the colonists to revolt. Immigration soon diversified the population mix, but in the 1790s, the country's Anglo-Saxon character remained largely intact. Jefferson often told of a dinner discussion that he had about British politics with Adams, Knox, and Hamilton in Philadelphia in 1791. They were discussing the corruption of the British political system, the system of royal patronage and pensions, the unequal size of electoral districts, and so on, when the following exchange occurred. Mr. Adams observed, "Purge that constitution of its corruption, and it would be the most perfect constitution ever devised by the wit of man." Hamilton paused and said, "Purge it of its corruption, and it would become an impracticable government. As it stands at present, with all its supposed defects, it is the most perfect government which ever existed." Jefferson gave this comment a sinister gloss, but Hamilton was merely saying that the crown needed patronage to offset Parliament's power of the purse. In The Federalist, number 76, Hamilton had described the tendency of popular assemblies, in England and elsewhere, to encroach upon the executive branch. Admiration for Britain's unwritten constitution and representative government had been commonplaces of colonial rhetoric. John Marshall said of pre-revolutionary America, "While the excellence of the English constitution was a rich theme of declamation, every colonist believed himself entitled to its advantages." Only 7 months before the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson wrote, "Believe me, dear sir, there is not in the British Empire a man who more cordially loves a union with Great Britain than I do." During the fight to ratify the Constitution, Patrick Henry praised the British Constitution as superior to the new American version. It was not illogical for patriots to see their new government as realizing British ideals that had been wantonly trampled on by the crown. It was France, not England, that had long been associated with despotic government, and Hamilton's high praise for England was not as heretical as Jefferson pretended it was. To Jefferson, it sometimes seemed that Hamilton wasn't just content to run the Treasury Department, but wanted to annex the State Department to his domain. Some of this can be ascribed to Hamilton's ambition, some to the minute size of Washington's cabinet, and some to the fact that Hamilton's system hinged on customs duties from mostly British imports. The affairs of Treasury and State could not be easily pried apart. As mentioned earlier, even as Jefferson lobbied for closer trade ties with France in early 1791, Hamilton had launched freelance contacts with George Beckwith, an informal emissary of the British government. Hamilton had told Beckwith that Britain could help her case by granting full diplomatic status to the United States and naming an official ambassador. Americans felt demeaned that Britain had sent no representative since the Revolution. Hamilton's hints bore fruit when the British sent 28-year-old George Hammond to Philadelphia in late 1791. Already a seasoned diplomat, Hammond commenced the first of many private chats with Hamilton. Hammond wrote to London, "I had a very long and confidential conversation with Mr. Hamilton, in the course of which the opinion I had entertained of that gentleman's just and liberal way of thinking was fully confirmed." Hammond withheld his credentials from Washington, however, until the United States agreed to post an envoy to London. George Hammond arrived at a critical juncture, with the United States and Britain still trading endless recriminations about which side had reneged on the peace treaty. America chided Britain for failing to surrender its northwest forts and not compensating planters for slaves it had spirited away, while Britain complained that America still had not paid off pre-war debts to its creditors. Hamilton impressed upon Hammond the vital need for Britain to relinquish the forts and conceded the justice of British claims for repayment of old debts. The one issue that Hamilton again refused to push vigorously was compensation for emancipated slaves, a vital point for Jefferson. When Hammond downgraded the importance of this item, he noted with pleasure that Hamilton seemed partly to acquiesce in his reasoning. It is possible to fault Hamilton for poaching on Jefferson's turf with Hammond while also recognizing that he salvaged talks that Jefferson wanted to sabotage. Jefferson treated Hammond to a frigid reception such as he himself had received in London. Hammond complained of the Secretary of State that it is his fault that we are at a distance. He prefers writing to conversing, and thus it is that we are apart. Hamilton despaired when Jefferson dredged up stale arguments about the justice of the American Revolution, and he apologized to Hammond for the intemperate violence of his colleague, assuring him that Jefferson's views were far from containing a faithful exposition of the sentiments of this government. Jefferson's pro-French bias prevented any real progress from being made in Anglo-American relations during his tenure at state. When the British minister wanted to know whether a thing was or was not unreasonable, Elkins and McKittrick note, he found the Secretary of the Treasury a better guide than the Secretary of State. Hamilton, for his part, subverted moves by Jefferson to negotiate a commercial treaty with France. This internecine warfare between two ambitious, relentless politicians began to immobilize policy in the Washington administration. On issue after issue, ranging from redemption of war debt to creating a national bank, Washington had sided with Hamilton against Jefferson and Madison. Washington shared many values with Hamilton, relied on his eclectic knowledge, and tended to be swayed by his judgments. This posed a dilemma for Republican critics of the administration because Washington was still America's hero and a political untouchable. To assail him outright was thought to be political suicide. Hamilton, vulnerable as Washington never could be, therefore became the necessary boogeyman. How could Jefferson hound Hamilton from office without tipping his hand? A proficient political ventriloquist, Jefferson was skilled at using proxies while keeping his own lips tightly sealed. The mouthpiece he chose to broadcast his views was the poet Philip Freneau. The Republicans had been bedeviled by the Gazette of the United States, a paper edited by a former Boston schoolmaster, John Fenno, who was adoring in his treatment of Hamilton. Hamilton had urged Fenno to start the paper in 1789 and later raised money to rescue it from financial distress. It was a quasi-official paper since Fenno did work for the federal government and was even listed in the 1791 Philadelphia Directory as an officer of the U.S. government. Jefferson denounced the Gazette as a paper of pure Toryism, disseminating the doctrines of monarchy, aristocracy, and the exclusion of the influence of the people. Jefferson and Madison decided to groom Freneau as a foil to Fenno and make him editor of a Republican newspaper. Educated at Princeton, Freneau had been a friend and classmate of James Madison before the Revolution. As a crew member on a revolutionary privateer, Freneau had been captured by the British and subjected to 6 harrowing weeks aboard a prison ship, leaving him with a lasting detestation of England. The so-called poet of the Revolution, Freneau was known for his scathing ridicule of English royalty, including his caustic description of George III as the Caligula of Great Britain. He had also rhapsodized Washington as a second Diomedes, whose actions might have awed a Roman hero or a Grecian god. 3 days after Washington signed Hamilton's bank bill on February 25, 1791, Jefferson, at Madison's behest, tried to lure Freneau to Philadelphia by offering him a job as State Department translator at a modest $250 annual salary. Freneau knew only one foreign tongue, French, and was poorly qualified for the post. In Hamilton's view, this sinecure disguised the real design. Indeed, Jefferson hinted to Freneau that the translation job gives so little to do as not to interfere with any other calling the person may choose. When Jefferson and Madison made their botanizing tour in 1791, they breakfasted with Freneau in New York and urged him to move to Philadelphia to launch an opposition paper. Jefferson volunteered to toss in small State Department jobs, such as printing legal notices, to give the paper extra income. He later denied making any such promises. In his acerbic account of these events, Hamilton observed of Jefferson, "He knows how to put a man in a situation calculated to produce all the effects he desires without the gross and awkward formality of telling him, 'Sir, I mean to hire you for the purpose.'" By July 1791, Freneau agreed to take the job as State Department translator, and on October 31st, the maiden issue of the National Gazette appeared. This freewheeling paper soon became the foremost Republican organ in America. Like other newspapers of the 1790s, Freneau's National Gazette did not feign neutrality. With the population widely dispersed, newspapers were unabashedly partisan organs that supplied much of the adhesive power binding the incipient parties together. Americans were a literate people, and dozens of newspapers flourished. The country probably had more newspapers per capita than any other. A typical issue had 4 long sheets crammed with essays and small advertisements, but no drawings or illustrations. These papers tended to be short on facts. There was little spot news reporting, and long on opinion. They more closely resembled journals of opinion than daily newspapers. Often scurrilous and inaccurate, they had few qualms about hinting that a certain nameless official was embezzling money or colluding with a foreign power. Nothing can now be believed which is seen in a newspaper, Jefferson later said. Truth itself becomes suspicious by being put into that polluted vehicle. No code of conduct circumscribed responsible press behavior. Signed articles were relatively rare. Perhaps the era's most prolific essayist, Hamilton seldom published under his own name and drew on a bewildering array of pseudonyms. Such pen names were sometimes transparent masks through which the public readily identified prominent politicians. The fashion of allowing anonymous attacks permitted extraordinary bile to seep into political discourse, and savage remarks that might not have otherwise surfaced appeared regularly in the press. The brutal tone of these papers made politics a wounding ordeal. One contemporary critic said of newspaper publishers, "Like birds of a game, they make sport to the public as their party prompts or supplies them with materials. By this practice, our elective privileges are converted into a curse." Though Jefferson and Madison were the chief instigators of the National Gazette, Jefferson had to move cautiously, while Madison could be more open. Madison solicited friends to subscribe to the paper, explaining that he did so from a desire of testifying my esteem and friendship to Mr. Freneau by contributing to render his profits as commensurate as possible to his merits. That Madison held high partisan hopes for the National Gazette is evident from a letter to Attorney General Edmund Randolph, in which he rhapsodized Freneau as a man of genius and described the need for a newspaper that would be an antidote to the doctrines and discourses circulated in favor of monarchy and aristocracy. By now, monarchy and aristocracy were standard code words for Hamilton and the Federalists. One of Jefferson's main weapons in discrediting Hamilton was his own insatiable appetite for political intelligence. After noteworthy discussions, Jefferson scribbled down the contents on scraps of paper. In 1818, he collected these snippets of political chatter into a scrapbook he called his Annus, a compendium of table gossip. In these pages, Hamilton figures as the melodramatic villain of the Washington administration, appearing in no fewer than 45 entries. These horror stories about Hamilton have been regurgitated for two centuries and are now engraved on the memories of historians and readers alike. Unfortunately, these vignettes often cruelly misrepresent Hamilton and have done no small damage to his reputation. Jefferson understood very well the power of laying down a paper trail. By coincidence or not, Jefferson recorded his first Annus item right after Freneau agreed to take the State Department job. Jefferson was credulous when it came to tales about Hamilton and believed implicitly in the Anglophile royalist demon he conjured up. In the Annus, he fingered Hamilton as the cat's paw of a cabal that wished to defeat the Constitution and install a British-style monarchy. Never mind that Hamilton had written the bulk of the Federalist papers and almost single-handedly gotten the Constitution ratified in New York. In his silent but lethal style, Jefferson stored up Hamilton's indiscretions. It was here that Jefferson recorded the story of Hamilton and Adams singing the praises of the British Constitution, of Hamilton supposedly raising a toast to George III at a St. Andrew's Society dinner in New York, and of Hamilton declaring at a dinner party that there was no stability, no security in any kind of government but a monarchy. The suspect nature of these stories can be seen in the anecdote Jefferson told of Hamilton visiting his lodging in 1791 and inquiring about three portraits on the wall. "They are my trinity of the three greatest men the world has ever produced," Jefferson replied. "Sir Francis Bacon, Sir Isaac Newton, and John Locke." Hamilton supposedly replied, "The greatest man that ever lived was Julius Caesar." What makes the story suspect, if not downright absurd, is that Hamilton's collected papers are teeming with pejorative references to Julius Caesar. In fact, whenever Hamilton wanted to revile Jefferson as a populist demagogue, he invariably likened him to Julius Caesar. One suspects that if Hamilton was accurately quoted, he was joking with Jefferson. The problem with the Annus isn't that Jefferson fabricated things. Sometimes he accepted second-hand gossip at face value. Sometimes he took a casual comment and blew it up into a monstrous portrait. Sometimes he missed nuances that would have cast matters in a different light. Take the references to Hamilton as an avowed monarchist. Hamilton had always wondered whether the Constitution would be durable enough to protect society and feared that a constitutional monarchy might be necessary. On the other hand, he had sworn to do everything in his power to give the new government a fair chance. In one Anna's entry of August 13, 1791, Jefferson got this emphasis right when he reported Hamilton as saying that the new republic ought to be tried before we give up the republican form altogether, for that mind must be really depraved which would not prefer the equality of political rights, which is the foundation of pure republicanism, if it can be obtained consistently with order. At other times, however, Jefferson was not so careful, stating baldly that Hamilton was not only a monarchist, but for a monarchy bottomed on corruption. The most damaging tale about Hamilton, however, came not from Jefferson, but from a much later book called The Memoir of Theophilus Parsons. Parsons had been an attorney general appointed by John Adams. The book was published by his son in 1859, 46 years after Theophilus Parsons died, and 55 after Alexander Hamilton died. The author contends that at a New York dinner party, soon after the Constitution was adopted, an unnamed guest was declaiming about the wisdom of the American people. Hamilton allegedly slammed his fist on the table and exclaimed, "Your people, sir. Your people is a great beast." The author added, "I have this anecdote from a friend to whom it was related by one who was a guest at the table." As Stephen F. Knott has shown in Alexander Hamilton and the Persistence of Myth, this report of an event that occurred 71 years earlier, relayed by someone who heard it from someone else, who heard it from someone else, has been trotted out at every opportunity by people seeking to smear Hamilton's reputation. Hamilton was wont to say that the world was full of knaves and fools, but this particular comment, if he ever made it, may have had a very different tone or intent from what has been imputed to it. On the afternoon of February 28, 1792, Jefferson sat down with Washington, ostensibly to discuss the post office. The real purpose was Jefferson's intention to warn Washington that Hamilton's Treasury Department was threatening to devour the government. Jefferson wanted the post office under his jurisdiction at state, because the Department of the Treasury possessed already such an influence as to swallow up the whole executive powers, and that even future presidents would not be able to make head against this department. As always, Jefferson piously disclaimed any political ambitions, said that he contemplated resigning his post, and noted glumly that Hamilton showed no signs of leaving. At breakfast the next day, Washington urged Jefferson to stay. Notwithstanding the general prosperity, Jefferson contended that the country's troubles arose from a single source, Hamilton's system, and he accused his colleague of luring the citizenry into financial gambling. Hamilton did not know about Jefferson's efforts to turn Washington against him. Jefferson grew more sedulous in propagating defamatory charges against Hamilton. At one cabinet meeting in April, Hamilton said that he would try to accommodate congressional demands for internal Treasury Department documents, but would reserve the right to withhold sensitive information. They might demand secrets of a very mischievous nature, he explained. For Jefferson, this was all a cover story. Here, I thought, Hamilton began to fear they would go on to examining how far their own members and other persons in the government had been dabbling in stocks, banks, etc., Jefferson wrote in his Annas. In May, Jefferson warned Washington that Philip Schuyler had advocated hereditary government at a dinner a few months earlier. That same month, Jefferson wrote a memo to Washington arguing that the ultimate objective of the Hamiltonian system was to prepare the way for a change from the present republican form of government to that of a monarchy. The incorruptible Washington had known Hamilton intimately for 15 years and was smart enough to dismiss these charges. Madison had become no less confirmed an opponent of Hamilton than had Jefferson, and thought his diabolical foe must be stopped. As Gary Wills has observed, Madison tended to think that those who opposed what seemed to him the obvious truth must have evil motives. Madison saw Hamilton grafting British-style corruption on America in preparation for a monarchy. Freneau's National Gazette provided a handy platform for Madison, and each month his anonymous blasts against Hamilton grew more withering. In February 1792, as Jefferson burrowed away at Hamilton from within the cabinet, Madison railed against a government operated by corrupt influence, substituting the motive of private interest in place of public duty. By March, Madison's critique of Hamilton had grown indiscriminate. Hamilton was coddling speculators, inflating the national debt, distorting the Constitution, and scheming to bring aristocracy to America. A master legislative tactician, Madison was now recognized as the first opposition leader in House history and had most of the South lined up solidly behind him. Among other things, Madison may have resented that Hamilton had replaced him as Washington's confidential advisor. In an attempt to stymie Hamilton, Madison tried to exert legislative control over the Treasury's power to raise money for the Army for an upcoming Western expedition. Madison did not prevail, but Hamilton was aghast that his former friend tried to curtail his power so drastically. As he said afterward, Madison well knew that if he had prevailed, a certain consequence was my resignation. Abigail Adams saw the anti-Hamilton campaign emanating from Virginia. "All the attacks upon the Secretary of the Treasury and upon the government come from that quarter," she told her sister. "But I think whilst the people prosper and feel themselves happy, they cannot be blown up." Fisher Ames also saw systematic opposition to Hamilton coming from Virginia. "Virginia moves in a solid column," he told a friend, "and the discipline of the party is as severe as the Prussian. Deserters are not spared. Madison is become a desperate party leader." That spring, Hamilton closely monitored the National Gazette. While Freneau glorified Jefferson as the illustrious patriot and the colossus of liberty, he presented Hamilton in satirical terms, mocking him as Atlas. In early May, he taunted Hamilton with this verse: "Public debts are public curses. In soldiers' hands, then nothing worse is. In speculators' hands increasing, public debts a public blessing." Nor did Freneau exempt Washington from his mockery. When Hamilton made an innocent proposal to place Washington's face on the new currency, Freneau saw royalist tendencies at work. "Shall Washington, my favorite child, be ranked amongst haughty kings?" That such anti-government diatribes were being published by the paid translator for Jefferson's State Department was finally too much for Hamilton. He concluded that Jefferson and Madison had mounted a concerted effort to drive him from office. He wasn't being just criticized, but crucified. With an imagination no less suspicious than Jefferson's, he saw a populist conspiracy out to destroy him. After years of restraint as Treasury Secretary, Hamilton's mind and emotions were now at full boil. On May 26, 1792, he wrote a remarkable letter to Edward Carrington, a revenue supervisor in Virginia, that virtually declared war against Jefferson and Madison. Hamilton shed discretion and let his deepest feelings gush forth. He told Carrington that as early as the debates over his funding system, people had given him hints of Madison's enmity, but he had not believed them. Now the scales had dropped from his eyes. "It was not till the last session that I became unequivocally convinced of the following truth, that Mr. Madison cooperating with Mr. Jefferson is at the head of a faction decidedly hostile to me and my administration, and actuated by views in my judgment subversive of the principles of good government and dangerous to the Union, peace, and happiness of the country." Of the systematic opposition of Jefferson and Madison, Hamilton declared, "My subversion, I am now satisfied, has been long an object with them." Hamilton seemed more anguished by Madison's betrayal than Jefferson's. By this point, Hamilton saw the mild-mannered Jefferson as a fanatic with a settled malice toward him, if not toward the federal government itself. Madison had always impressed him as the more brilliant and honorable man. Now he concluded that Madison had fallen under Jefferson's sway. "I cannot persuade myself that Mr. Madison and I, whose politics had formerly so much the same point of departure, should now diverge so widely in our opinions of the measures which are proper to be pursued," Hamilton told Carrington. "The opinion I once entertained of the candor and simplicity and fairness of Mr. Madison's character has, I acknowledge, given way to a decided opinion that it is one of a peculiarly artificial and complicated kind." Not for the last time, Hamilton tried to refute the grotesque fantasy that he belonged to a monarchical party that meditated the downfall of republican government. He conceded that he and kindred spirits held less populist beliefs than Jefferson and Madison, but that they would regard as both criminal and visionary any attempt to subvert the Republican system of the country. He wanted to give the Constitution every possible chance. "I am affectionately attached to the Republican theory. I desire above all things to see the equality of political rights, exclusive of all hereditary distinction, firmly established by a practical demonstration of its being consistent with the order and happiness of society." If he had wanted to impose a monarchy upon America, Hamilton said, he would follow the classic path of a populist demagogue. "I would mount the hobby horse of popularity. I would cry out usurpation, danger to liberty, etc., etc. I would endeavor to prostrate the national government, raise a ferment, and then ride in the whirlwind and direct the storm." He denied Madison was doing this, but was doubtful about Jefferson, a man of profound ambition and violent passions. Lest Carrington consider these views confidential, Hamilton indicated that he had thrown down the gauntlet to both Jefferson and Madison. "They are both apprised indirectly from myself of the opinion I entertain of their views." The period of covert skirmishing had ended. Open warfare had begun. George Washington watched this feuding in his cabinet with dismay. He was no longer the swaggering young general of the Revolution, but a craggy, aging man with parchment skin. His gray eyes seemed smaller, more deeply set in their sockets. He was plagued by rheumatism, and his painful dentures, crafted from hippopotamus tusks, rubbed agonizingly against his one remaining good tooth. William McClay found his complexion pale, nay, almost cadaverous, his voice hollow and indistinct, owing, as I believe, to artificial teeth before his upper jaw. Washington clung to an idealized image of the president as a citizen king above partisanship. This pose was more and more difficult to maintain with a bitterly divided cabinet. Jefferson sniped privately at Washington as a vain, close-minded man, easily manipulated by flattery. His mind has been so long used to unlimited applause that it could not brook contradiction or even advice offered unasked, Jefferson complained to a friend, adding that "I have long thought, therefore, it was best for the Republican interest to soothe him by flattering where they could approve the measures and to be silent when they disapprove." Unable to believe that Hamilton won internal arguments on their merits, Jefferson concluded that Washington was being hoodwinked. If not an intellectual, Washington was fully capable of independent judgment and could not be tricked or coerced. When Jefferson later accused him of falling under Hamilton's influence, Washington reminded him irritably that there were so many instances within your own knowledge of my having decided against as in favor of the opinions of the person evidently alluded to, Hamilton. By early July 1792, it was clear that George Washington would not have the option of silence or inaction in stemming the feud between Hamilton and Jefferson. He had probably waited too long to assert control. His fine, nonpartisan stance may have only intensified the partisan mischief between his two appointees. The slanderous hyperbole of Philip Freneau's National Gazette now soared to a new pitch. To commemorate July 4th, Freneau ran a front-page article listing the rules for changing a limited Republican government into an unlimited hereditary one, and mentioned Hamilton's programs as the most effective means for doing so. Other articles followed with equally heavy-handed hints that Hamilton and his retinue planned to enslave America under a monarchy and an aristocracy. To provoke the president still further, Freneau had three copies of the National Gazette delivered to Washington each day. Before leaving for Monticello for the rest of the summer, Jefferson again sat down with Washington to persuade him that a corrupt squadron of voters in Congress was in Hamilton's pocket and voted for his measures only because they owned bank stock or government paper. Washington exhibited growing impatience with Jefferson's warnings of a royalist plot and stated flatly that he endorsed Hamilton's policies. "Anyone who thought otherwise," he told Jefferson, "must regard the president as too careless to attend to them or too stupid to understand them." On July 25th, Hamilton planted in Freneau's Gazette of the United States the opening shot in a sustained volley against Jefferson. Signed T.L., this letter posed a simple query about Freneau and his State Department stipend. whether this salary is paid him for translations or for publications, the design of which is to vilify those to whom the voice of the people has committed the administration of our public affairs. The letter was just one paragraph, yet it could not have been more momentous. The Treasury Secretary was making anonymous public accusations against the Secretary of State. Hamilton had returned to his old career as a bare-knuckled polemicist, and Freneau relished the chance to retaliate. 3 days later, he tarred John Fenno, his Federalist counterpart, as a vile sycophant who printed the journals of the U.S. Senate and received more money from the government than he